Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. This episode is from the Momentum Series, resurfacing the most popular episodes from our archives to shine a light on the continued growth of companies in our network. And now, on to the show.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinStrat Management. Super excited today because on our podcast, we have Nick Jain, CEO of IdeaScale. Nick, great to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Why don't we jump right into it? I know our audience is eager to hear your story. So let's start with your background. I would love to hear what inspired you to start IdeaScale.
Sure. So I didn't actually start it. I was hired in as a CEO. But by the way, just as an aside, I love that the podcast is called Innovators Investors because IdeaScale is the largest innovation software company on the planet. And most of my career was spent as a professional investor on Wall Street at being a hedge fund and private equity guy. So to answer your question, I didn't start IdeaScale, but IdeaScale was started by two guys about 15 years ago, Rob Hohen and Viv Hoskaran. And what they realized was, look, there's all these large organizations out there, NASA, Pfizer, McDonald's, right? They're really good at whatever they do, but they're all struggling to become more innovative to prepare for the challenges of tomorrow, whether that be new products or internal operational improvements. And everybody's just doing it by throwing people at it. And that's rarely a solution to a problem, right? The way you solve a problem is by applying better technology and better processes. So they built IdeaScale 15 years ago, and now we're proud to be the largest innovation-specific software company on the planet. We're like, in the way that you have HubSpot or Salesforce as your CRM, you have NetSuite or QuickBooks for your accounting systems, we are the OS for chief innovation officers around the planet.
Wow. Okay, so interesting. So they bring you on. What background can you share with the audience as to why the founders thought you were a great fit?
Sure. So my quick background, I studied to be a scientist, spent the first 10 years of my career in Wall Street as a professional investor, investing in a variety of companies, tech companies, healthcare companies, aluminum companies, whatever, like big multi-billion dollar deals, business school at Harvard. And then somehow about 4 or 5 years ago, I've ended up as what I would call a professional CEO. People hire me to run companies when they're ready, either require a turnaround or ready for that next stage of growth. The largest I've done is a $100 million revenue trucking company with 1,000 people, physical goods, warehouses, all that fun stuff. Did it also helped with a small men's shoe startup that was $2 or $3 million and then was brought into IdeaScale. And the reason they brought me in was two reasons. Number one, again, I'm a professional CEO. I know how to take a business that is small or medium size and make it global or more impactful. And number two, I know how to professionalize the business in, so not just make it bigger, but how to make it fundamentally scalable and more stable. God forbid, if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, IdeaScale will live beyond me because I am not the company, which is the way a big company should be, right? Like McDonald's CEO or Pfizer or Nike CEOs, God forbid, if they ever get ill, Pfizer doesn't discontinue as a company. And that's how you want to build a strong, resilient, scalable organization.
So how then did your investment experience on Wall Street shape or inform the way that you think about building the company?
Sure. I think three things. Firstly, I got to see a lot of businesses at Wall Street, good businesses, bad businesses that were like really poorly run or well run. So you could just get a lot of experience, right? You got to see HR departments versus finance departments versus sales departments, both good and bad. So I've seen all the different types of business and enough permutations about what's good and bad. So a lot of experience and learning that would decades of experience compressed down into a much shorter time span. Number two is on Wall Street, you get really good at understanding how does a business make money, right? I think a lot of things that are one of the things that a lot of founders or executives of even mid-sized companies is they don't understand how the business makes money. And that's really important. And then the third is, how do you make good decisions? So a lot of people make decisions because it feels right, it sounds right, somebody made a fancy presentation. IdeaScale and all the companies I've run previously are run on a very clear principled methodology, which is we are going to make ROI positive decisions. It sounds really simple, but that's how all capitalism should work. But surprisingly, a lot of organizations, A, don't know that principle, or B, don't have the analytics to back it up. And that's the final thing. Like we run our company incredibly analytically, whether we talk about HR, which we don't run HR just on feelings, but rather on like actual math, same with sales, same in operations, same with technology. And that means we make consistently good data-backed decisions in every part of the company.
Before we dive a little bit into the product and its market, long-term vision for IdeaScale?
Two things. Number one, we started expanding. We started expanding globally about a year ago. So we don't want to be just like an American or Western company. We want to be the innovation operating system for everyone in the world. So that's a global impact. Number one. Number two, we want to be the one-stop shop. And number two is we want to be the one-stop shop technology shop for any chief investment officer. So if you need any, if you want to have a great innovation department, we should be able to provide you every piece of technology that you need if you're the chief innovation officer of any mid or large organization in the world.
And a little bit in the weeds, but practically, how does that play out? Are you guys like a menu and then you bundle everything together depending on their inputs?
Sure. So right now, for most of our history, we were basically a one product company. We had the best in class idea management or crowdsourcing solution. It's a way you collect ideas, figure out which ideas are good or bad. Almost think of it like a prediction market or like a CRM for ideas. We added a whiteboarding module about a year ago. We're adding project management module in about a few months and some AI modules a few months after that. The way we envision the commercial model is customers should pick any module that you want or all the modules. It's an a la carte menu with really designed to support whatever problems you have, right? If you don't need a whiteboarding solution because you have something else or your business doesn't need it, great. Don't buy, I'm not going to force you to buy it. If you pick, we want to be there to solve our customers' problems in whatever way they want us from a technology perspective.
Got it. Now, I heard chief investment officer. Are they indeed your target audience, or is there any other personas?
Chief innovation officer.
Chief innovation officer. Are there any other personas who are your target audience, or does that role sum it up?
No, I would say there's three groups. Obviously, if organizations, if they have a chief innovation officer, chief R&D officer, that's what we're literally built for. A lot of organizations either don't, number one, or there's other personas that we target. The second very common persona is chief human resource officer or chief human capital officer. Our software is really good at getting employees engaged. And so it decreases turnover, happier, more productive employees. And then third is either chief strategy officers or chief executive officers. Because one of the things that every like chief executive officer, chief strategy officers are going to think about is how do we stay relevant tomorrow? And so they're concerned about, they may not call it innovation, but they're definitely worried about, we need to get better for tomorrow. And what software, what product, what technology do we need to able to achieve that systematically and continuously? We don't just want to get better once. We need to get better tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, the day after tomorrow. And so they look for a process to do that. And we hopefully provide them a really good technology on how to do that.
And so I love this idea of you have something amazing, you want to share it with the world without revealing any trade secrets or secret sauce. What's the plan to make your market, the world, available, know that you guys exist?
So look, there's no secret for most software, right? We have a product that helps you collect ideas, helps you rank up and down ideas. That's true with almost any software. If you wanted to rebuild Salesforce, you probably could. There's not a lot of like crazy proprietary technology there. And that's true with most software companies. I think what makes us different is three things. Number one, an insane effort on quality. So my software is just not buggy. I spend a lot of time, money, resources, making sure it just works. And that sounds really silly, but a lot of software companies are spending more money on sales and marketing than they are in just making their product work, or they're adding bells and whistles or features that are unessential. My product just works. It takes 2 minutes to set up and it just works. It's not going to crash on you. It's going to not lose your data. Security's there. Like, it just works. Number two is we care about our mission. Like, I genuinely want to dominate and provide the world of innovation management software. I care about it personally. I care about innovation mattering. I care about getting better tomorrow. That's, I think almost every employee at IdeaScale really believes in that. And that shows through, and we work our butts off, right, to achieve that from a product perspective, from a customer service perspective, from a how we run the company perspective. And number three, and this is more on the like our customer service side. Look, every technology company has a bunch of software. We also have, even in the age of AI chatbots, we have a 24/7, 365 human customer support team. So if you, on Christmas Eve, you need, if you have a problem, whether it be a technical problem or just you need to know how to do something, look, yeah, you'll chat with the chatbot for about 4 seconds, but within, if you need to talk to a human being, our average human response time is 28 seconds from our customer support team. So that's insanely good, obviously, right? And our customer, if you go read our, you know, reviews on G2 or Gartner or anywhere else, that people love it and they've loved it for 15 years. And I credit the prior CEO for us for building that out. And I'm continuing that legacy where that's, you get humans at IdeaScale. Even though we're a tech company.
I love it. So said another way, the emphasis is on user experience and allowing them to be your advocates, as compared to a lot of companies who will take that money and apply the budget to sales and marketing versus product development.
Yeah, and customer. I spent $0 on Google ads and maybe like $1,000 on LinkedIn ads last month. My average competitor spends rough between 10 to 50 times what I do on a monthly basis.
And I personally love it. I've come across a lot of CEOs who think similar. Let the product and the experience speak for itself. It's brilliant. I like it.
Thank
good
you.
On you too. I'm sure the market would be a better place if we had more people who thought along those lines. A tiny pivot. Let's talk fundraising and investor relations. Audience would love to hear what your experience has been within IdeaScale. And if there's anything you want to pepper during your Wall Street experience, all ears.
Sure. So we're in an interesting place because IdeaScale has been 100% bootstrapped. It is owned by one guy who's a serial entrepreneur, and he provided the initial capital. And we've been profitable almost since day one. So entirely bootstrapped. Today, I'm in the very fortunate, the average tech company of our size has taken on a lot of venture capital. They're often loss-making. They have negative EBITDA. We've been modestly profitable throughout our history. And then under my leadership, we've been exceptionally profitable. We have the profit margins of large publicly listed companies on a percentage basis. So we're very proud of that. We don't need money. We, in fact, are looking for great ways to deploy capital. Conversely, I get calls from venture capitalists who want to invest in me. I say, no, thank you, because I don't need growth capital. I get calls from private equity firms who want to just purchase us. And that's obviously ultimately of interest at some point. My board has asked me to always keep an open mind and continue those dialogues, engage with people that, hey, if someone offers us the right price, we are obviously willing to sell. That's one of the reasons, obviously, I was brought on, because I'm able to have those discussions and know what's like a good price, because most of my career, I was on the other side of the table where I was trying to buy or invest in other companies. I think the interesting thing I would say that is, or the interesting insight that is relevant perhaps to your audience today, is the market, the tech investment market, I think, is a lot more sophisticated on the founder side today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. I think 5 or 10 years ago, you had a lot of 20-something Silicon Valley types graduate from Stanford or dropped out of college or whatever, and they started the companies without understanding how the venture capital markets worked, how contracts were structured, things like that. There's a lot more sophistication amongst founders, as well as a lot more options for them to pursue other forms of capital that are perhaps more attractive or have fewer strings attached. In addition, there are a lot more bootstrapped companies where the original founders or the investors decided, we're going to grow a little bit slower by not taking on capital, but it will allow us to have a lot more control and flexibility, which is the situation IdeaScale is. And most of my competitors, almost all my competitors, are venture-backed. So they have a lot more strings attached or pressure to achieve certain things, especially because they're almost all loss making. Whereas I have the world, I can go invest in my product because, hey, I make money. It's a lot easier to go build a product or go sell something or go expand when you don't have to beg somebody else for money. And when you know you're, you know, not putting your company or your employees' jobs at risk, you sleep a lot better too.
100%. And obviously the control that having one shareholder on the cap table affords you is significant.
Yeah.
But that said, I admit I'd be curious, obviously investment savvy. I love the idea of looking at projects on an ROI basis. We could probably devote an entire podcast to the subject of leverage, but how do you think about debt financing for purposes of maximizing returns?
Sure. So I personally am a big believer in debt financing. I own one or two pieces of investment real estate, and they're levered to the maximum that is risk safe, right? As a private equity guy, where I'm very familiar with capital structure, using leverage, including fancy forms of leverage, derivative leverage, pref equity, tiered debt, whatever you call it, right? I think at IdeaScale, my board has preferred not to, I've floated the idea of using debt financing just to take advantage of low interest rates. I think my board has preferred not to for two reasons. Number one is, while we've been exceptionally profitable for under my tenure, that's only 2 years so far, right? We don't know whether Nick had a fluke for 2 years, right? Like, in all honesty. The second is, I think my board, for better or worse, has realize, look, they like the idea of a no strings attached ownership where you don't have to respond to debt owners, you don't have covenants. And that's a lifestyle or decision choice when you reach a certain level of success or wealth. And again, that you may say, look, I'm going to forego a little bit of the returns, but in exchange for sleeping better. And I think that's a decision my owners and boards have made thoughtfully. It's not we don't like debt, we don't like leverage. It is, there's a trade-off, were willing to accept a little bit lower return, but to in order to sleep better at night and not to have to deal with bankers or debt firms. I personally like advocate for it, and we may go back to that at some point in the future, because the good thing about my owners and board is hyper rational people. When it makes business sense, there's no dogmatism there.
Yeah, and for benefit of the audience, I think that makes great sense. Whenever you look at a portfolio strategy, there's absolutely reward ROI, but there's also risk. And if your risk profile is to be more conservative, that's absolutely a consideration, to especially with that in the interest rate environment, given we're no longer a decision of whether or not you're going to bring on a facility.
One more thing. Bringing on debt enhances returns only if it allows you to deploy that capital more effectively. So if I was to raise a bunch of debt, I'm in this unique situation where I'm a profitable company, where I'm cash flowing, I'm accumulating cash on the balance sheet. Let's imagine I raised a bunch of debt capital the way I would in a private equity situation. I'd be left with one of three circumstances. Either number one, I have a bunch of cash sitting in a bank account earning whatever 1% interest rate in a 5% inflation environment. So that's losing money. Or two, I would have to do a share buyback, which my shareholders doesn't really matter. It's moving money from his left pocket to his right pocket. Or number three, I would have a war chest that I might be incentivized to go do bad things with. You never want your CEO to have go be an empire builder. So many companies, both large and small, their CEOs are incentivized to be empire builders because they just feel rich. At IdeaScale, look, if I want to go acquire a company, I can either borrow money from my investors, go raise debt capital, or fund it from my balance sheet. And we're open to doing that, right? However, there's no need to, because right now, if I raise capital, it just sits on the bank account and earns a negative interest rate after inflation, which is the worst of all worlds.
100%. And actually, beautiful segue, because you just read my mind as one of the next questions. I'd love to hear how you think about acquisitions.
Sure. So I'm in a really fortunate situation, as I said, like bootstrap, profitable, no politics, one board owner who's thinking very long-term, almost generationally, right? We could hand off this company to his kids and I'll be working for his kids in 10 or 20 years, which I'd be fine with. They seem like great people. However, my competitors just candidly are not as fortunate. Almost all of my competitors are venture-backed, loss-making companies that are anywhere between negative 20% EBITDA margins to 0% EBITDA margins. So I would like to consolidate the market for two reasons. Number one is, as a market right now, we're highly fragmented. There's depending on how you count it, between 5 to 20 players that are doing similar things. I think we are the best, both as an operational company in the terms of quality of the product, but there are alternatives to me. And it would be much better from a valuation market rationality perspective, as well as providing a better quality product to our customers, if we can have one big $100 million revenue company rather than 10 $10 million companies, for example. So I believe the market consolidation is coming. Almost every software market only has one or two players, right? You look in CRM, it's HubSpot or Salesforce, and there's a long tail, but it's really two options. In finance, in CRMs, ERPs, you basically have NetSuite, QuickBooks, and I'm blanking on the third one. So number one, I want to consolidate the market. I think that's the right strategic position. But number two, I think IdeaScale and me personally are well situated to run the market better than a lot of other peers. Like, we just have run the company profitably for 15 years. That says something, right? Both under my predecessor and under my leadership. And so I would love to go buy all of my competitors out or merge with them. The exact transactional structure can vary. I'm pretty flexible there. But then we can have a more valuable entity. And I think we can do that really effectively because we have the war chest to do and the operational discipline to do so really well. And that creates value for everyone, right? You take two smaller size companies, join them together and run them better. That's like a great win outcome for everyone. And it's a great time in the market to do so, because as venture capitalists have pulled back from loss-making mid-sized or smaller mid-sized SaaS companies, it's an opportunity for folks like us to step in and say, look, we have money and we know how to run a business really well here.
And it's a great position to be in. Tip my hat. And I'm sure there are a lot of companies who will wish that they were in a similar scenario. But with that, running any business is not without its challenges. I'd love to hear, over the past 2 years, what's one of the biggest ones you've had to contend with and how did you resolve it?
Sure. So I think I'll give two examples. Number one was when I stepped in, I don't think our product, when I joined, our product quality was not at the level that I would want to be, that I want to be selling or be proud of, right? One of our internal Slack channels, I think one of my earliest quotes to the entire company was, I do not want to be in the business of selling snake oil. I want a product that is really high quality, right? So we spent the first 6 months of my time on the product side. We just shut down all development and we just said, we're going to focus 100% on quality, not because we were bad, but because we were not best in class. And that was a strong demand. So today, I have probably three times just the quality assurance and bug engineers as all of my competitors. Not because like we're three times less efficient, but because I care a hell of a lot more about actually having a good product. That's number one. Number two, so that's a problem we had to fix. And that required a lot of effort, a lot of resources, and just an entire mental shift of the company that it's so easy as a software company to get into the habit of, we're just going to toss out a lot of features really quickly, get into this agile development cycle, bells and whistles, customer wants a bell and whistle, we're going to build a bell and whistle, rather than say, A, have the guts to say no to a customer because it's a bad feature, or B, take time to build it right rather than half-ass it. The second challenge was on the marketing side. I think it is very easy for a software company just to spend a bunch on like Google advertising or LinkedIn ads or whatever your target advertising channel is. We were certainly not the worst offenders there, but our marketing was not effective. It did not generate leads at all. Our inbounds when I joined was zero. We had zero inbound opportunities a month. And so that required a fundamental rebuild of our marketing function, from really silly things to, we didn't have a talk to sales button on our website when I joined, which like day one, that was like a week one change. Like, we need a talk to sales. And if somebody wants to come buy our software, they need to be able to talk to sales. That's a really silly one. But there were a whole bunch of things, adding like a freeware version of our software that's available to small businesses. Hopefully they graduate. And then going to dominate content and SEO. For example, now it took us about a year to do it, but if you search the word innovation management, innovation best practice, anything related to innovation or creativity, we're a top three Google result alongside, it's usually Harvard Business School, McKinsey, Wikipedia, and us in some combination in any language in the world. And that was because we just worked our butts off to put out the best content possible. So like, you go read our blog, it doesn't even mention the word idea scale. We're not trying to fake sell you our software with a thinly disguised ad. It's like the best in class content out there on innovation, like thought leader, like good thought leadership. So that was really hard, right? That was a year and a half effort to build a marketing function that did not exist into a best in class in our industry marketing function. I can unequivocally say my marketing function is miles ahead of everyone else in my industry combined.
That makes complete and total sense. I consistently hear my own personal experience, but also talking to other members in the C-suite, that the ability to showcase your expertise in today's world is crucial, and totally makes sense. With that, best-in-class product, an argument can be made is only as good as the people behind it. So I'd love to hear what your take is on fostering a company culture that attracts top talent and keeps them motivated.
Sure. So yeah, 100%. Human capital, we call our human capital department human capital, not human resources. It is not an administrative back office function the way a lot of organizations, their HR is basically somebody to, you know, set up interviews and make payroll. At IdeaScale, we think of human capital as an actual function to manage human capital, entrance, development, exiting, all that fun stuff. To do that, I think we do three things. We try and do three things. Number one, for hiring people, our hiring process is systematic and scientific. So it's not the typical, many companies have just fit interviews. Do I like you during the interview? No, IdeaScale tests for skills in whatever function, even quote unquote qualitative functions, whether you're a software engineer, whether you're a marketer, whether you are in HR, or finance, you get skills-based testing that objectively sees, are you good at this job? Number two is, this company, I think, is we try really hard to run an internally idea meritocratic company. That's what our product is. But philosophically, we believe like everyone's voice here matters. It's not a democracy, but best ideas win. What that means is, if you are a junior guy sitting in South Africa or a new hire in Mexico, you're new to the company, you may or may not have English language skills, doesn't matter. Your voice matters here. If you have a good idea, it gets done and you get appreciated for that. Appreciated can be whether it be soft pats on the back, promotions, compensation, all that. We reward people for contributing here. And then number three is accountability, right? I'm a mathematician by training. I'm a big believer. And for my Wall Street days, if you can't measure it, it's not real. So we measure performance here in every function, including functions that a lot of companies think are too qualitative to measure. So we measure the value of our HR function or the value of our engineers. That creates both transparency as well as accountability. And accountability doesn't mean in a negative sense, but rather people know that, hey, if I'm not achieving the goals that were set out, that may not mean that I suck at my job. It may mean that the process I'm pursuing is bad. Hey, if my goal is to generate leads and I'm trying a bunch of, let's say, webinars, and they're not generating the leads I need, that doesn't mean I'm bad. It just means webinars is a poor channel and I should reorient to SEO or to live events or to physical flyers or billboards or whatever. And that creates the ability for individuals to self regulate and hold themselves accountable and pivot rapidly versus an organization where there's not data transparency and accountability.
I love it. No, that's good. I think feedback loops are underrated. And if you can establish them at scale throughout each department, that's brilliant. I love it.
Yeah, it's hard, but we do it.
I wish we had more time. It would be great to unpack it. And with that, we are coming up to the end. But before we go, what advice do you have for any aspiring CEOs out there?
I'd say two pieces of advice. Number one, go spend a bunch of time learning continuously. I spend between 10 to 20 hours a week, like taking additional courses and training myself. I already got the job, but I know I need to be smarter tomorrow. So I've taken courses in prompt engineering, algorithms, this all in the last like month and a half, right? I'm taking like just CEOs need to continue learning even once you have the job, or whether it's certainly on the way to get to the job. But once you have the job, if you just say, you sit on your butt and I got the job, it's a cool chair, then you're going to lose the game quickly. The second is be willing to grind. I think a lot of people incorrectly assume that it's just talent or connections that either get you the job or make you successful in the job of an executive. A lot of it is grind over many years, willing to put in the hours and do the grunt work that no one else is. It is not glorious, but it leads to impact in almost any field of endeavor, whether it be being an executive of a company or a professional athlete. Like those guys, LeBron probably spent an insane amount of time in his high school gym at 6 a.m, just shooting 2-pointers when everyone else was like sleeping. And that's probably not glorious, but that pays off over years and decades of effort.
Yeah, I think we don't see that part. And so we just see him winning championships and thinking, oh man, he's naturally gifted. And man, that's all there is to it. On the contrary, there is absolutely a concept of compounding returns when you put the time in. So totally makes sense. Nick, thank you so much for coming. A lot of great insights here. I genuinely appreciate you taking the time to share them with our audience. If anyone wants to find you or learn more about IdeaScale, how do they do it?
Two ways. First, you can go to ideascale.com. Our software is completely free for organizations less than 100 people, even if you're an individual entrepreneur. So would love if people checked it out. Obviously, if you're a large company, would love if you became our customer. For me personally, the best way to reach me is via LinkedIn. My name is Nick Jain. I respond to 100% of messages on LinkedIn. So feel free to reach out.
Great. Nick, thank you again. And to our audience, I hope you enjoy the podcast as much as I did.
Thank you, Christian.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. If you'd like to know more, go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.